Spent 68 years of my life there. Taught school for 45 years there. And, of course, that part of my life centered around Paramount. I went to Paramount Elementary School, and then I went to Haverty Grass High School, where I graduated in 1921. And after that, I took training, teacher training at Towson, well, it was the old State Normal School then. Now it's Towson University, isn't it? And Western Maryland College, University of Maryland. Paramount at first was the original school was within a church, our Methodist church. It was a two-story building, and the church was in the second floor, and the school was the first floor. And my mother and dad attended that. And then when the church was torn down and rebuilt, and then a two-room school was built next door to it. And that's where I attended until the school burned in 1914. And then a larger school was built, which they called, was to be a consolidated school, because at that time they were closing lots of little one, two-room schools throughout the county, and they were consolidating them into larger schools. And Paramount was to be a consolidated school. However, that never came, because that was in 1916, and in 1918, the Proving Ground took all the land below Paramount, and all the schools, of course, were closed. That was Michaelsville, and Bowdoin, and Bush River Neck, and Booth Hill, and a union at Stepney, all of those schools. So there was no potential there for education. However, remained a two-room school until 1968, when they closed it, and that was the year I retired. Now, I don't know whether the school closed and then I retired, or whether I gave up and they closed the school. Never could figure that out. Then all the children were bused to Hillsdale Elementary School in Aberdeen. And then that year I sold my home in Paramount and I moved to Aberdeen. And I stayed in Aberdeen until March of 1985. And then I left there and came here to the apartment, where I've been ever since. But I've enjoyed it. I've become a member of the Bel Air Golden Age Club. At the present time, I'm a vice president of that club and also the program director. So I had plenty to do there. I also have joined the Stepping Stone Museum. I'm a life member there, and I volunteer there once a month during the summer at the Visitor Center. I'm a member of the Harford County and the Maryland Historical Societies. I belong to the Genealogical Society of Harford County. That may be all. I'm a member of the Cranberry United Methodist Church at Paramount, having joined there when I was 13 years old and been a member all my life. In fact, my family built the church when it was built in 1862 it was started. Now what else do you want to know?
Or maybe would you like to tell us about your parents and what it was like for them when you were being raised as a child?
Well, my mother and father were both born in the vicinity of Paramount. My father was born in the town of Paramount. My mother was born and raised on a farm about 2.5 miles below Paramount, which was absorbed by the Proving Ground. My grandmother lived on the farm, and of course that was during the Civil War, And I can remember her saying that they hid all the horses in the woods at that time because the Union soldiers were coming down and taking the horses that they had. So they hid them all in the woods. I remember that. And of course, my mother was a farmer's girl. My dad grew up to be a train dispatcher on the Pennsylvania Railroad and worked out of Wilmington. His office was in Wilmington. He rode the trains every day. My grandfather, Taylor, was a blacksmith and a wheelwright and had a wheelwright shop in Perriman. Well, life was easy. I mean, I really never knew of any hardships at all. We had a very easy life. And of course, at that time, they didn't make much in wages. My father didn't, but we managed to have a good life. We had 2 acres of ground, and he had a large garden. And of course, a horse was our means of transportation then. But in 1913, we bought our first car, and it was a Buick, a red Buick with brass trimmings. That was quite something. And we've always had Buicks ever since. Someone called me up the other day on the telephone, a fellow from the Dodge, and he wanted to know if I wasn't it. He said I was interested in a new car. And I said, why, no, I just bought a new car. Well, wouldn't you be interested in a Dodge? I said, no, I wouldn't buy a Dodge if I were buying one. I said, I've been used to Buicks all my life. I had a brother and a sister, and I've lost both of those since, well, my brother died in 1981, and he had worked at the Buick place for 50 years. Worked for the Lees, and then of course he worked for Clarence Boyle after that. My sister married and moved to Philadelphia, and then on to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, but she died quite young. All of my mother's people were farmers. The family just seemed to be congregated around the Perriman area, most my uncles and my great uncles and all of them. They were always there. Although my mother's side of the family came from Connecticut originally. They were Gallups, and they settled in Mystic, Connecticut, and from there they came to Newcastle, Delaware, and then to Spasusha Island, and then to the Perriman area. My dad's people, I think they were from Baltimore and Baltimore County, which was old part of Harford County, or Harford County is part of Baltimore County at one time, or they were all together. But I just don't know about them. Now what else?
Do you remember anything about your father's railroad job, about the different railroads of that day?
Well, of course, at that time, when he worked on the railroad, we had a train north and south that stopped at Perriman every hour, except during the nights. They started at 5 o'clock in the morning going north, and then at 6 going south. And then at 7, we had one north and one south. At 8 o'clock, we had one north. At 9:30, we had one south. At 10, north. 11:30, south. Then there was one at 1 o'clock, north. At 2 o'clock, south. At 4 o'clock, south. At 5:15, north. At 6 o'clock, south. At 8 o'clock, north and south. At 12 o'clock, north and south. That's the way it was then. You could just get trains at any time. And now there isn't any station. The station's gone. And there's a fence down the whole length of the railroad tracks. railroad crossing that we had there is gone. It's fenced up. There's just nothing there. We had a crossing watchman that was there at the crossing, and of course he raised and lowered the gates when a train would be coming. My dad started out work in the tower at Perriman, or it wasn't at Perriman, it was halfway between Perriman and Aberdeen, and he had walking to do, to walk to that tower. That was before he was married. And he made 50 cents a day. And then, of course, they were known as operators. And they had levers that they had to pull back and forth to set the signals, you know, for the train either to go or stop or whatever. That was hard work. Then, of course, he became a train dispatcher and, as I say, went to Wilmington. And then he had to operate the trains by telephone. He gave orders to the operators in the towers who had to fix the switches for the trains to operate. And twice a year he had to go over the line, the railroad lines, to watch the signals and to see that everything was up working order. He had to go over the main line, which was from Baltimore to Wilmington. That was his section that he worked, operated. And then he also had to go over the line from Baltimore to York, Pennsylvania, which was the Northern Central line. And he also had to go from Wilmington to Harrisburg, which was one of their lines. He ended up working the what we call the CNPD, which was from Perryville to Columbia, up the Susquehanna River. It's just one track line there. Yeah. And he rode the trains every day. He had to leave home at 5 o'clock in the morning, and he didn't get home till 6 o'clock at night. So his day was pretty well taken up with work. Then, of course, when they did away with all the train service, that is, they cut down the train service, why, then he had to, we would have to take him to Perryville to meet the train. And then he could come home on the train all the way to Perriman, but he had to take the train from Perryville to Wilmington, which made it hard for us because we had to drive him there. Perriman was a real active little town at one time before the war came, before the Proving Ground came. It was very active, but after that it just killed the town, killed everything in it.
Or could you maybe tell us what all this activity was before APG came along?
All right. I'll read it right here. Before World War I, 1918, Perriman was the hub of a wheel, reaching out to several local areas. To the south, on what is now Perriman Road, was Bush River Neck. The road went to Abbey Point on the mouth of Bush River in Chesapeake Bay. This farm was owned by Mr. Winfield Harris, who later sold it to Mr. Morris Clothier of the famous Strawbridge and Clothier department stores for a gunning club. Mr. Aaron Ripken, grandfather of young Calvin Ripken, Jr., was Mr. Clothier's overseer. The government put a stop to that operation in 1917. To the east was Boothby Hill. There was a school there, at one time a post office, but most of the land was devoted to farming. To the southeast was Michaelsville, a little self-contained community, in that it had a general store, an undertaker, a post office at one time, a colored church, which was the forerunner of Union Church at Swan Creek, Garrison's United Methodist Church, and a farm called Gravely, which was the site of the first Episcopal Church, leading to establishment of Spasusha Church. Hall's Crossroads, which was later Aberdeen, was to our north. We didn't have much contact with this area except the Cranberry Church, then a Southern Methodist Church, relied on Grace Church, a Southern Methodist Church, until 1942 for our ministers, all of whom were from the Virginia Conference. Before 1918, there were four general stores. J. Edward Gary on the east side of the railroad crossing, J. H. Emmert opposite Perriman Railroad Station, Michael Sherling opposite Gary's, it burned one winter evening, and S. A. McGuigan's, which was situated about a quarter of a mile from the center of town on the road to Aberdeen. Gary's and Sherling's catered to the black trade, and on Saturday nights the road around their stores were crowded. Mr. Emmert had a soda fountain. His special trade was from the young people, and when the Aberdeen Proving Ground was in operation, many of the soldiers made the fountain their hangout in the evening. Mr. Emmert also delivered orders to the canning houses during the canning season. Morgan Mitchell and Ralph Mitchell at Short Lane, corn canning, and F.O. Mitchell. His store had the post office situated in one corner, and Miss Ella Cronin was the postmistress. Mr. McGuigan's store had the general trade, but his son had a livery stable and rented teams to traveling salesmen, and so of course the salesmen bought there. His store had a hall as the second story with a kitchen, and he rented that to the two churches for suppers. More about that later. There were two feed, coal, lumber, and hardware stores, which were very active. Mr. Otha Johnson owned one that stood adjacent to the railroad on land opposite the trailer park. A railroad freight station stood there too. Mr. Carl Holloway, my uncle, owned the other. In addition to coal and lumber, he dealt in farm machinery and bought and sold wheat and corn, which the farmers raised to sell. He sold the old Majestic cooking range when it appeared on the market. Don't remember that, do you? We had a butcher shop which was in the building now next to the post office. Mr. Sam Lauder was the butcher. Then Mr. Tollinger came, and when they closed shop, we had our meat delivered from Aberdeen. Mr. Victor Adams came in a team of two white horses and a white covered wagon, and when he stopped, he would put up the back cover, pull out the scales, cut the beef or whatever you wanted, receive the money, and drive off. There was no ice or ice box to keep it cold, and no flies. A blacksmith shop and wheelwright shop, operated by my great-grandfather, Joseph Everest Taylor, cared for the farmers' horses and wagons. My grandfather worked there, too, and later built his own little shop, which stood at the end of our lane where the Alfred Wood House is now. The main shop was just across the road next to the McGuigan livery stable. The wheelwright shop had two stories. Carriages and buggies were painted on the second floor. The first floor was where repairs were made. Later, Mr. Henry Boats, whose home stands on the corner of Michaelsville and Perriman Road, opened a blacksmith shop in back of Emmert's store. Mr. Boats closed his shop in 1918 and went to work as a blacksmith at APG. You want all that?
Well, that's quite all right.
That was told you mostly about what Perriman was like, the buildings that were there. For recreation, in summertime, we'd have a merry-go-round come into town for a week. We'd have Hunt's One Ring Circus come into town for a week. We'd have spelling bees in the Perriman School basement. We'd have dances, strawberry festivals. We had a shuffleboard on the floor of the school basement where we played. We had lawn fetes. We had peach festivals, church socials, and watermelon socials. In winter, we had ice skating. We had to walk about 2 miles to skate on the ice. It was called Hinchman's Cove, but it was in the upper part of Bush River, just north of the Beta Shoe Company, up in that area. And we had to walk the fields and climb over the fences and build a fire when we got there. It was rough, but we did it. We had coasting on the hill, and we did have some church socials in the wintertime, and we did have dinner parties. And if we had enough snow, we had a farmer who would put in that time they hauled corn in wagons, and we'd have the body of a wagon. We had a farmer put the wagon on runners and hitch up his horses and take us on sled rides in the winter. Perriman as a village was always centered around the railroad station. All businesses were in that area. In addition to those already mentioned, there was a barber shop and shoe repair shop. The first post office was in Perriman Railroad Station. and the postmaster in my early days was Mr. Frank Johnson. Pearman Station was a brick building with two waiting rooms, one for ladies and one for men. The office ran through the middle with ticket windows on each side. Each had a pot-bellied stove for winter and burned coal. The ladies' side had a rocker, long benches, and a mirror. The baggage room and cuspidors were on the men's side. Telegraph keyboard was in the office for sending messages. All agents and operators had to learn the Morse code. There were no telephones until later. The station was torn down in the 70s. Just north of the station was a tavern or a small hotel. That was before my time, but when putting in the third track of the railroad, they unearthed the foundation. Across the tracks was built an ice cream factory owned and operated by F.O. Mitchell and Brother. It burned and was never rebuilt. A cheese factory was built on Cranberry Run, just where the Spasusha Road and the old road to Aberdeen meet, opposite the Bardonsky home, and a mill was in back of that. Water power was used to run each, and that was on Cranberry Run. Canneries were an important part of the economy of Pearman. John W. Bay had a tomato cannery operated by my uncle, Harry Holloway, on Old Bay Farm on Michaelsville Road. Towners had a tomato cannery in Bush River Neck. F.O. Mitchell and Brother operated their cannery on the present site, canning corn and peas. E.V. Stockham had a canning house for corn and tomatoes at Chelsea Farm on Bush River, about 2 miles below Pearman. Mr. Stockham's office was in the building opposite the Jordan's house. After the Aberdeen Proving Ground came, Mr. Stockham moved his cannery business to Havertygrass, and the office became a YMCA for the soldiers. The staff held dances in Pearman School basement. When Mr. Stockham's cannery closed at Chelsea, the house was occupied by soldiers who had been sent there to help build the proving ground. They had horses and wagons and did the hauling. Recreation for them was coming up to a Cambridge store soda fountain and dances. In order to show their appreciation, they held several dances in the barn at Chelsea, and everybody from Pearman was invited. If people had no way of getting there, some of the soldiers came up in a team of horses and a farm wagon filled with straw to take them down. It was a lot of fun. The boys furnished the music, and square dancing was the order of the day. Mitchell's business was operated from an office in Mr. F.O. Mitchell's home until the office across from the post office was built. Emmerich's store was one of the meeting places for the men of the neighborhood. On winter evenings, they would collect to sit around the fire, smoke, spit tobacco juice, talk, swap jokes, and play checkers. I worked in the store at 14 years of age on Saturdays in winter and every day in the summer, including some nights at the soda fountain. Food wasn't packed then. Most everything was in bulk. Coffee beans had to be ground on a huge grinder with a big wheel. Vinegar had to be drawn from a big wooden barrel. Molasses, too. Lard came in 50-pound cans and had to be dipped out into trays and weighed. Bacon came in large slabs, as did fatback, and had to be cut and weighed. The women used cell soda for washing clothes. It was kept in a large wooden bin on the floor. You had to bend over and put your head partway in the bin to see what you were doing, and did that soda smell? You don't know anything about that either. Sugar came in sacks and had to be dumped into bins and weighed out and bagged and tied. Farmers and their wives brought butter and eggs to the store in exchange for the things they wanted to buy. If they didn't spend all that, Mr. Emmert gave them for the eggs and butter. Then he wrote out a due bill for that amount, and they could use it the next time they came. When Pearman School burned in January of 1914, school was held in Emmert's Hall until 1916. Our playground was the lot or small field where Mitchell's office is now. It was fenced for pasturing Mr. Emmert's horse. Other meeting places were the railroad crossing watchman's box and the railroad tower. The box was just at the end of the northbound platform next to the crossing. you about the tower.
Oh, yes.
And my dad.
Would you like to tell us about what it was like when you were going to school, or not as teaching, as when you were a student, some of the classes or extracurricular activities they had?
Well, it really wasn't too much about it. Of course, we had school from 9 to 4, and we had recess, you know, which they don't have now. And at recess time, we went out and played games, and we had an hour for lunch when we played games. We sat around little groups and talked. We had desks where two sat, the two desks, an inkwell in the center. We had the blackboards were up on the wall, and in order to get to them, they had platforms where you had to stand because they were too high for you. So you had to have to stand on the platform to write on them. They didn't have any lights in them so that nothing could be held there at night. This was the old two-room school I'm talking about. There were only two rooms, and then there were sliding doors in between so that when we had a Christmas entertainment, the doors could be folded back, you know, and the two rooms could come together for the program. The teacher's desk, of course, was up on a platform. And I know it was cold walking to school, back and forth to school. I had about a half a mile to walk in the day and in the winter time. And of course, we had the pot-bellied stove in the middle of the room. And one time, it caught on fire around the chimney up in the roof. So then we were all dismissed for the day. That was good. During those days, we really didn't have too much to keep us busy. I mean, we met maybe at nighttime. In the summertime, we'd meet down at a friend's house on the corner where the two roads came together. We'd meet down there and maybe we'd play games until the sun went down, and that was it. Of course, there were no movies. We didn't get to Aberdeen, no transportation. Well, the roads weren't too good either. We didn't have very good roads. They weren't paved. And they didn't have movies in Aberdeen. It wasn't anything in Aberdeen, only during the winter in February, they would have a man from Baltimore and his wife would get up minstrel shows, and they put on a minstrel show for two nights in Aberdeen for the benefit of the fire department. And then we'd go to that. It was quite a thing. And how we went, my dad we'd go up on the 8 o'clock train from Perriman, and then there was no train to come back on. So my dad, being a train dispatcher, he could ask for a train to be stopped. So they'd stop a train at Aberdeen to pick us up and stop it at Perham to let us off. They wouldn't do that today. there wasn't too much else. We visited around among our relatives, and that was about it. We had picnics. Our church had a picnic every summer down at Old Baltimore. And then on Saturday nights, they had dances down there. Of course, I was too young to dance, but I went with the, you know, because I didn't have any babysitters then. So I went with them. And they'd have a musician from Baltimore to come up and play for the dances.
Would you like to tell us about when you were in Haverty Grace High School? What was that like?
Well, I went to Haverty Grace High School for 3 years. And I left Perriman in the eighth grade and went to Haverty Grace. And, of course, the building isn't there now. They tore that down and built the new gymnasium in Haverty Grace. But we had a lot of fun while we were there. There were 21 in our class, 21 graduated. And we have managed to have reunions each year since then. And at the present time, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of us left. And we didn't have one this year, because at the time we were going to have it, one of our didn't cost me anything because I got a school pass, my dad being on the railroad. And there wasn't too much to do in high school until our last year, and then we had class parties at different people's homes, you know, to celebrate the last year of school. But other than that, there wasn't too much to do. We would play hooky once in a while. There was a circus, a Downey circus, that wintered in Haverty Grass. And before they went out on the road in the spring, they would always pitch their tent to see that it was good, you know. And they'd go through some of their acts, practice their acts. Well, we'd play hooky and go over there. We'd have a study time. And of course, that study time, we were over there in the tent watching them practice their acts. That was about the only thing that took our time.
Would you like to tell us about when you went to Towson Normal School?
Well, that was only summer. I took my training at these places in the summer. I didn't graduate from any of them. I took my training in the summers and did extension courses at these different places. So, but that was, to Towson was by train then, back and forth each day. Western Maryland, I went out and I stayed there during the summer. And University of Maryland, I stayed there too. But I got all of my points for a first degree certificate, so that was all right too, but I did it the hard way.
Or when did you become a teacher for the county?
In 1923. And I retired in 68. Mm-hmm. I began by teaching fourth and fifth grades in Perriman. It was at the time in 1923. Well, when the Proving Ground came in 1918, they established a school on the Proving Ground for the children. And Perriman was still a two-room school. However, in 23, they wanted to do away with the school at the Proving Ground and put the children into schools out in the county. So, since Perriman was so large, you know, they had the basement and they had the two rooms upstairs, they made it a three-room school. And they had the first three classes downstairs, and the fourth and fifth I had, and the sixth and seventh was in the other room. And of course then high school started in eighth grade. And so that's how I became a teacher. I had taken the examinations, and so then Mr. Wright asked me to come into teaching. So then of course I had to prepare myself afterwards. So I had to start in 24 and do it all the hard way. But I enjoyed it. Fourth and fifth grade were an experience. And then I had fourth and fifth, and then I had first, second, and third. I think the Proving Ground School came there for 2 years, and then they went to Aberdeen. And so then we went back to a two-room school again. So then I had first, second, and third grade, and the other teacher had the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh. But then I had to take the fourth grade after 2:30 in the afternoon for two classes. And it went that way until, goodness, I don't know when. 1951 or 52, we had so many children, we had four teachers. We had the two rooms upstairs, and the basement was with two teachers downstairs, one on one end, one on the other. Mm-hmm. And we had four teachers, and we had that for, I think, 2 years. And then, or a year and a half. And then that passed by, and we went back to two teachers again. And then I was made, the teacher who was the principal went to Hillsdale. No, she went to Bakerfield. And I was made teaching principal in 1955. And then there was another girl with me. And I had first and second grade, and she had third and fourth. And then when she left in 2 years' time, they took the third and fourth to Hillsdale. And then we only were left with first and second, so I had first grade and the other teacher had second grade until they closed the school. Mm.
Or what were some of the things that you had to teach them, or just what
was
it like?
Well, I taught all the subjects. I taught them all. It was only in later years that they had we had a music teacher. And up until that time, of course, I had to teach music to the children in my room, singing, you know, songs. And if there was artwork, that had to be done. Everything. You had to know a little bit about everything. I took an art course and music courses and all the subjects.
Or can you discuss what it was like them being a teacher during that time?
Well, it was very satisfactory. I wouldn't go back to teaching again, but I enjoyed it. And I had a lovely group of children all the time. I think maybe outside of a few instances, you know, where you have discipline problems, everything just went along fine. I can't say that there was anything difficult. I enjoyed it. And most of the children were pleasant to teach and accepted what you had to teach. But for the last 2 years that I taught, I could see a change coming in the way children were being instructed at home, being raised. The parents were both working, you know, and I didn't have that up to that time. But it was, of course, during the war, and both parents were working. Some were in the services, and the mothers were working other things. And they were latchkey children, you know. They'd come to school. In fact, I had one little boy who came to school in the morning, and he had to wait until 5 o'clock to get home at night, I mean, to get in the house. And one time, he didn't go home. They couldn't find him when nighttime came. And they searched all over Pearman, and they finally found him hidden in a, what do you call them? That they put under roads, you know, to take the water.
Oh, a sewer?
Well, it's like a sewer pipe, yes. Uh-huh. You know, those big pipes that are under to take the water away. That's where they found him hiding.
Was this during the 60s, you said?
Yes. Yes. His father had been sent to Cambodia, and his mother was working. And when he came to school in the morning, well, he didn't get in till 5 o'clock in the evening. And he'd either have to go to a neighbor's, or he didn't know where he was going. It was pitiful. I don't know where that boy is today. My heart ached for him, and he was a nice child. But it was problems like that I could see coming. And then it got to the point where you couldn't discipline children. You didn't dare discipline because parents wouldn't have it, you know. They'd come with a big argument about what did you do to my child. So I really was glad to get out. But I did enjoy it while I had it.
Or I guess just over the years, what changes have you seen take place in Perryville as well as the county?
In Perryman.
Or Perryman.
That was one thing. It used to be called Perrimansville. When the railroad went through, it was Perrimansville and Perryville. And when, of course, coming from Baltimore, they'd come to Perrimansville first, and people wouldn't be listening. They'd hear the bell, and they'd get off, thinking they were in Perryville, see? And, of course, then they'd have to wait for the next train to go to Perryville. So they changed it to Perrim and took the bill off, and that eliminated that problem. Perrim today is not what it was. I dare say that I don't know. I may know a half a dozen people, half a dozen families in Perrim. Not more than a dozen. Our church is still there. Really, our church is stronger at the present time than it has been for a number of years. But they're all new people in the church. Most of them are. And all of the older heads are gone. All of the homes have been changed hands. There are only two. There are only two living in Perrim now that are living in their original homes, and that's the Mitchells. Fred Mitchell, and of course his father died last October, but his home's still there. And outside of that, all the others have been changed, or new ones built. And there's, as I say, Gary's store as a building is still there, I guess. I haven't been down there lately, but it was very dilapidated looking the last time I was there. And Emmeridge store is no more. The railroad station's gone. All of the business buildings have gone, all of them. There's nothing. The Wiggins store is still there as such, but a family from India live in there now and use it or run it. And I said, to think that a family from as far away as India would get into a little town like Perrim. I just can't imagine it. I don't know whatever brought them there. They keep a nice store. It's nice and clean. And they're very polite people, but I just can't see it.
Or would you like to tell us about the church that you attended there? You said it's getting stronger now.
Well, in the way of... I mean stronger because we've had ministers that have been active and working in it. When we started out, we were with the Virginia Conference, and we were a Southern Methodist church. That is, we belonged to the Virginia Conference. And of course, those churches broke away, you know, during the Civil War,
yes.
Northern and Southern, so we were Southern. We remained that way until unification in 1941. And then, of course, they all became just United Methodist Churches. Up till that time, our ministers had all, as I say, come from the Virginia Conference, which was south of the Potomac River. We had to have church in the afternoon because they were at Aberdeen, and Aberdeen had church in the morning. And Aberdeen had church at night, so we had to have our services in the afternoon at 3 o'clock. Well, the farmers couldn't come because that was starting their milking time, you know. So usually we had nothing but women. We didn't have too many men. My dad was always a member there and a worker there, but he never could come in the afternoon because, of course, he was working on Sundays. He worked every day. There wasn't a day when he had off, you know, in those times. He had to work every day. It was only in the later years that he even got 2 weeks vacation. And that wasn't, he retired in 1937 because of cataracts on his eyes. And I guess that was back in the first part of the 30s. And of course we didn't have very good attendance, but we always met our financial obligations, no matter what. Then at that time we did have an Empress League, a junior Empress League, and an adult Empress League. And our church just gradually died down. And then in 11 years ago, what would that be?
Well, that'd be, I guess, 65 or 75.
1976. We had a retired minister who had once been in Aberdeen, and he had retired from the conference. And he was persuaded to take our church because we had no minister. And he really built the church up. Everybody liked him, and he really built it up. And he was with us for 5 years, 6 years. And then he wanted to retire for good, so we felt like he should. And he didn't have very good health. So then our minister came from the Proving Ground. He was a chaplain at the Proving Ground, but he wasn't acting as chaplain. He was a counselor there. And on Sundays, that meant he didn't have any work to do, so he would be our minister. So he came, and we had him for 2 years, Major Gillespie. And then he was sent to Korea. He was told that he wouldn't have any more foreign duty, but they sent him back to Korea. And so then we had to get another minister. Well, then we got a Reverend Roberta Scoville. Her husband is a mental health officer here in Bel Air, Ralph Scoville. And they live over at Homestead. And she came with us for 3 years, and she was in training to be a minister in Lancaster, and she was very good too. And all three of them just had a knack for building up the church and bringing people in, and everybody liked them. So Roberta had, this year she was called to one of our big churches in Baltimore as Christian Education Director. And now we have a minister, well, she isn't a minister, she says she's training for it, from Jarrettsville. So I don't know what will happen there, but we're in the process. But it's too bad that we have to change all the time. Of course, we had to change when we were Southern Methodist, because they had a policy in the church that the minister could only stay 4 years, which was a good policy because we knew we were going to get somebody else. But now we don't know when we're better off. The cornerstone was laid in 1866, and then the two-story building was torn down in 1888 to build the present building. The present church had a belfry that was removed in 22, and then in 1964 an armored surplus building was purchased from the Aberdeen Proving Ground, and we made that into our present church school building. There it is there. And this is the building we purchased, and this church had a belfry, but the belfry was too heavy for the roof, so we had to remove the belfry.
Well, are there any other, I guess, papers you might like to go over from that you have over there? Anything you might see of interest?
Now, Swissosha Church is very interesting. You know, of course, it was established in the 1600s, and the first one, as I said, was Gravely Farm. And then I think the church that's there now is the third church on that site. And in the churchyard is a brick, little brick building that was the first school in Perriman. And my grandfather attended that. And they have recently restored that, and it's now on the historical calendar. No, Perriman was really, all the land around it was a farming community. And it was too bad when in 1918, when the proving ground came, it just devastated everything, people and everything. They had to move. I mean, they only had a certain amount of time to move, and it was a very, very cold winter. And I remember that one farmer from way down in Bush River Neck was moving up, and he was moved some things up to his brother-in-law's right next to us. And at 2 o'clock one morning, New Year's morning, he was throwing off things in the yard, lumber and everything like that. It was making such a sound, and it was so cold, these potatoes froze on the way from his home up there, just a short distance. But it just devastated everything, really did. All the farms had names. Bay Ridge, Oakdale, Chestnut Hill, Romney, Red House, Pennycome Quick, Star Farm, Woodley, Chelsea, Taylor's Hall, High House, Stony Point, Bay Shore, Queechee, Park Farm, Brick House, Old Baltimore, Good Tidy, Abbey Point, Beaver Dam, Poverty Island. Those were to name a few. The farming was done with wooden plows drawn by a pair of horses or mules, and corn was planted by dropping in rows. And then the corn had to be hoed and suckered to keep the weeds down. People were paid 50 cents a day for that in heat and back bending. When sugar corn was ready for the cannery, it was gathered in large baskets and dumped into horse-drawn wagons and hauled to the cannery. No, it was I don't know of anything else. Of course, all the different things that they did to live, hog killing and cutting ice and things of that sort. Didn't want that, did you?
Well, if you'd like to say a little bit about it, you know, it would be interesting anyway.
Well, everybody had an ice house. It was, ours was triangular, and the roof came almost to the ground. It maybe under the eaves was just about that high above the ground, and everything was below the ground. It was dug out way down. You had to have a ladder to go down and a ladder to come up. And in the winter time, they'd go out to the coves or the ponds or wherever. We always got our ice from down what we called the creek, which was the upper part of Bush River up to Cranberry Run. And when that would freeze over, they had people who would go and cut the ice. And they had regular cutters that would cut it into great big blocks about this big, this long and this wide. And of course it was about that thick. And they'd put it on the wagons and haul it to the ice house. And of course they had these great big hooks that hooked onto it, you know. What do you call them? I call them clamps, but that isn't what you called it. Anyway, they'd lower them down into the ice house, and there'd be somebody down there to place them side by side, and then they'd have straw to cover them up. And each layer had to be covered with a lot of straw, and then they'd pack them down to fill the ice house. And that's what they did. And of course, when you wanted ice, you went down there to get it each summer. Didn't have refrigerators. Then, of course, when we did away with ice houses, we had an ice man to come from Aberdeen. It was an ice plant in Aberdeen and made ice. and the ice man would come in his wagon and haul the ice in great big blocks, and he'd chip it as much as you want, if you wanted 50 pounds or 25 pounds or what. And then you had a refrigerator. My mother's first refrigerator was a round one. And imagine putting a square block into a round refrigerator. And of course, every fall they had hog killing. And not everybody kept hogs, but there was a man who lived down below us who had hogs. And along around the second week in November, he would have hog killing. And in the morning, he'd build the fire outside and have this great big iron pot and put the water in it and get it real hot. And then while I was in bed, I'd hear these poor old hogs squealing, you know. They'd stick them and bleed them. And then, of course, they'd put them in the iron, in the pot of water to get the hairs soft. And they'd scrape the skin and then cut them open and take out all the insides and hang them on the gallows. And they'd hang on the gallows from till the next day before they'd cut them up. And then, of course, they'd have a time to cut up. When my grandfather had hogs, my mother would always go down on the farm and help with the cutting up. She'd have to be down there for 2 days because the second day they'd cut up the hogs, and the third day they'd make the scrapple and sausage and lard. All of that had to be done. I don't know, was there anything else? On 4th of July, we always had fireworks. We'd gather at my aunt's house in the evening, and we'd have fireworks. And then we'd have lemonade and cake. That was our 4th of July celebration. And once a year, in the summertime, my dad would take off, and he would go crabbing. And he'd go early in the morning and put out the crab line and crab it, you know, and cook the crabs, and then we'd take a picnic lunch and meet him and have crabs and lunch. That would be down on the waterfront.
Are there any other changes that you've might have seen? Any other changes, maybe in, I guess, real estate or businesses throughout the area?
Been so many changes, yes. There's a housing development we lived up on a hill, and there was a field, a farm next to us. And that field, front field, is now a housing development, which is, you never think would come to Perriman. And of course, another thing came to Perriman. One man sold his farm to the lock joint company that make the pipes, you know, these huge pipes that you see hauling along the road. That came to Perriman. And then this year, the Mitchell's Cannery has closed, so that's gone. And they closed both crossings in Perriman. We had a lower crossing and a crossing right at Perriman. And they closed that, and of course the state roads built this huge bridge over halfway between the two crossings to take care of the people that live on the other side of the track that are down toward, gas and electric company have a plant down there on that side of the track, all the way down to the proving ground. They're eventually going to build a power plant down there. Of course, when they bought the land, it was supposed to have been a nuclear plant. Then, of course, with all this evidence frightening evidence of nuclear plants, they decided they'd have it coal burning. And now they're wondering what to do with the ash from the coal burning plant, because of course the neighbors on the other side of the railroad are worried about that. So I don't know what they'll do. But it is right on Bush River. And they do have a plant down there now, that a generating plant that burns diesel, that takes care of the, for instance, in the summertime when you have to have excess wattage for air conditioning and things of that sort, then that plant goes into operation. And of course, the Mitchells were farming the land down there. I think they're still farming some of the land, but they're planting it in soybeans and field corn.
Or is there anything else you might like to add that you...
There isn't. No, I think I've told you everything that there was.